Peggy Hitchcock, always resourceful, at this point arranged for Dick to give acid to her younger brother Billy, then a budding stockbroker in the prestigious Lehman Brothers firm. Billy reacted with enthusiasm. It figured. He was an intelligent, restless, exciting, craving Millen heir and a true son of Thomas Hitchcock, legendary American flying ace and top polo player. Billy and his twin Tommy had just purchased a large estate in Millbrook, New York, 2 hours' drive up the Hudson River from Manhattan. It was a magical location, twice 5 miles of fertile ground with an imposing gatehouse complete with sallyport and a huge portcullis. From the gatehouse, a mile-long drive under rows of maple trees led to the mansion, 4 stories high with 2 towers. Gleaming white, with 64 rooms inside, it was surrounded by elegant lawns, stables, and an ornate 2-story chalet, which held a bowling alley. Billy and Tommy, now spirited supporters of our work, suggested that we establish our research center in the vacant main house. The plan to start local centers around the country would be scrapped. We would go low profile and in secluded isolation continue our legal and totally authorized research into altered states. We were pleased to be in Fitzhugh Ludlow neighborhood, the same area where the French Jesuit mystic Teilhard de Chardin was buried. We called ourselves the Castelia Foundation, emulating the fellowship of mystic scientists in Hermann Hesse's The Glass Bead Game. Once a week, we engage in a programmed LSD session. Typically, one crew member would be responsible for arranging the environment and the stimuli. The guide would read from philosophic or poetic works and select the music, all important in directing thought. Often, the guide would prepare special tapes to take us on specific ontological adventures. We saw ourselves as anthropologists from, say, the 21st century, inhabiting a time module set somewhere in the dark ages of the 1960s. On this little space colony in upstate New York, we were attempting to create a new paganism and a new dedication to life as art. It felt right and was, come to think of it, my boyhood dream come true. The world of conflict and political struggle seemed far removed, but trouble was lurking outside, grim and unrelenting. One night in November, I received a phone call from Laura Huxley. She said that Alice was dying and that he particularly wanted to see me about the manual we were adapting from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. The next day, I flew to Los Angeles. Since their house had been destroyed in the Hollywood fire, Aldous and Laura were living with a friend near Mulholland Drive. When I arrived, Laura took me aside, pressing my hand. Aldous, she feared, seemed unwilling to face the certainty of his death. Just that afternoon, he had spoken cheerfully about the inconvenience they were causing their friend and had mentioned renting a house when he recovered. Alice was upstairs in a hospital bed, motionless and weak. He smiled when I greeted him and began asking questions in a quiet voice about what we were doing, nodding with approval and chuckling softly at my jokes. Then he motioned me conspiratorially close. He said he didn't want to worry Laura, who couldn't face the fact that he was dying. He said he had known of his terminal illness when he wrote the scene in Island, his last book, where the dying grandmother was guided through the bardos. Aldous asked him if I would guide him through an LSD session with a psychedelic version of the Book of the Dead. I suggested that it would be much better if Laura guided the session and read him the instructions for reaching the white light. No, he said, I don't want to put any more emotional pressure on her. I plan to transfer my body during the trip, after all. The nurse entered, wheeling an oxygen tank, so I stepped out into the room where Laura was waiting. I told her about our conversation. She was more than willing to guide Aldous through an acid session when his moment of death approached. We discussed the research being done with Dr. Cast in Chicago, in which acid contributed dramatically to the serenity of terminal patients. As I said goodbye, Aldous whispered, "Be gentle with them, Timothy. They want to be free, but they don't know how. Teach them, reassure them." Well, everyone remembers exactly where they were on November 22nd, 1963, when the dreadful news hit. Television created a mass imprint in 100 million brains, a sudden loss of innocence. The assassination of Jack Kennedy was especially brutal to those born after 1946. It was their first intimation that dirty work was afoot, that the world wasn't the nice, safe place we parents and Dr. Spock had prepared them for. That evening, a friend at the Associated Press in New York called with an item he'd just pulled off the wire. Aldous Huxley had died. In the grief for Kennedy, almost no one noticed. That night, we held a long candlelight vigil for both of our departed guides.